Session number 7498, room 5.
Major Horridge, Reel 5. You were telling me of the incident at the bombing school.
Yes. Can I go on with that?
Yes.
Well, I think I've already said that the CO had told me to go and see the Brigadier. So I went to Brigade Headquarters. The Major who had been put in charge of this bombing didn't come from his brigade. He'd come from the Manchester Brigade. At any rate, I told the Brigadier what had happened, and he said, well, he said, I'm not going to be taking any orders from this major, and you can march him anywhere at 5 o'clock, as you were originally given orders to do. So, armed with this, I went back again. I continued to work until 5 o'clock, when I told the men to fall in. The major appeared from his dugout and said, I told you, you have to wait an hour longer. I said, I'm sorry, but we're going up the line tonight and I'm going to march them away now. He said, well, there's a lorry of wood just 150 yards away. Unload that and then you can go. I said, we haven't got time, sorry. Time is 5 o'clock and I'm marching my men away. He said, do you refuse to obey my orders? I said, I'm going to obey the Brigadier's orders. With this, I saluted, gave the orders a quick march. He said, you cheeky young pup, I'll get you court-martialed for this. So the end of it was, I was sent a notice from the brigade to give an account of what had happened, and I heard no more of it. And I don't know what the Major's account was either, so I know no more about it than that.
Would this conversation that you had with the Major, would the troops have been able to hear?
Oh, yes, they were there. Oh, yeah.
And
I heard it all right. I got a bit of kudos out of that, I expect.
Could you describe what went on in the rest areas?
No, you see, it was more or less routine. We went up into these trenches at the top of our gully ravine, and then we came back and we were in rest, sleeping on the cliffs just by the sea. And occasionally we received visits from Greeks who'd come from neighbouring islands. We could buy a few eggs, could buy a few things like that to help us out with our rations. But it was just a merely matter of routine, and there was nothing of any particular interest worth repeating.
Did you ever go bathing?
Oh, yes, we went bathing. Perhaps I could just add one little thing about bathing. We used to go and bathe at the beginning, when we had the centre section. We used to go and bathe in Morteau Bay, and of course the French had Senegalese troops with them. And I remember going to bathe once and having a conversation with one of the Senegalese, and they always had a bottle full of wine issued to them every day. So I remember swapping with him half a tin full of jam for a bottle of his wine, which we devoured in our leisure time.
Where did you live on
the beach? We asked me if we bathed. We did bathe from X Beach, around about there, and once or twice we were shot at by the Turks as we were bathing, which of course soon finished the bathing parade. We were back as quick as we could then, and bullets were splashing around in the water. They could shoot at us from the next bit of land that jutted out north of Spuselier Bluff.
Did you have any trouble from any guns in Asia firing at you?
Well, they did on the beach, because we never were on the beach. We didn't get anything from Asiatic Annie. Might interest you just to add one little bit of thing here. 1935, when I went to Gallipoli on the Duchess of Richmond, which was all run by the Royal Naval Division, and we got to Istanbul, and they produced the man who'd been running Asiatic Annie. Everybody was delighted. They went and shook hands with him. I said, "You didn't get me, you didn't get me." I think it was quite matey, all this business then.
Just one point I omitted earlier. When you'd been trained as a bombing officer, did you ever actually do any bombing of the Turks?
Oh, many of the men did. I didn't personally do any bombing. Oh, yes, one chap got medals for bombing for several hours, keeping them away from a barricade. He got the DCM.
But you just supervised them?
Well, the officer is an officer. You didn't go chucking the bomb yourself. You had to be doing other things. Not that you couldn't throw the bomb, but, I mean, you didn't. It wasn't your job, really. Your job was to see that you were properly protected and that, and you had other things to do while it went on.
What sort of recreation did you have in rest areas? Did you sort of... How did you pass the day?
We didn't have any recreation except talking and sleeping and eating. And I must put it in here. We were tired. You see, I've already been through this matter of little sleep at night, working parties during the day. And I have since written to an instructor of one of the big army schools in south of England, telling him that the generals didn't seem to realise how tired officers and men were getting with all this. And he answered me back and said it was a very good point, which he thinks should be brought forward. Because it's a fact. You see, you can't be the same if you're tired through being overworked all the time. I dare say it can't be helped, but it's unfortunate when it's done.
Where did you sleep when you were in the rest areas?
Oh, just on the ground. You had a sleeping bag, that was all.
What did you think of the Turks, your enemy?
We admired the Turkish soldier in the sense that he was a brave man. He was fair. He never tried any dirty tricks, as far as we know. I was told, whether I can't prove this, but I was told that they signalled to our headquarters that your battery is too near your hospital. Unless you move it, we shall have to shell it. They never fired at a hospital ship, which unless it remained longer than a certain time. When a hospital ship arrived, you were allowed to take the wounded. You were allowed 4 minutes to get them on the hospital ship. And if by that time the hospital ship wasn't moving off, the Turks would fire a gun across its bows. And I don't think it ever happened that they ever had to factory fire at a hospital ship. And you were allowed that length of time in which to load up. I think even the great Australians, I think, admired the Turkish fighters too. I might just add this, that in after days, when we were on the desert in Egypt following up the Turkish army and having to find wells and things like that, they never tried any dirty work like poisoning wells or anything like that. I don't think that any of us who fought against the Turks have anything but admiration for the way they carried on.
How did the various allies get on, the Australians, New Zealanders, French and Indians? How did you get on with...
Well, I have no personal knowledge after leaving Egypt, where, of course, we were with the Australian in Cairo and some in Alexandria. After that, I never actually came in contact with them at all.
How about
we did have an Indian corps of some kind, which ran about little carts and carried things about. But I never actually was with the Australians or the Indians or the Gurkhas. Or I and these other people.
What did you think at the time of the high command and the staff work of those involved, or did you not think anything?
I don't think that we ever criticised them. We just realised they were running the show, and we did what Compton Commander told us, or what the CO told us. I don't remember hearing anybody running down the head generals or corps commander or divisional commander. I don't remember that at all. I don't think they did. I think they just thought they were doing the best they could, like everybody else was.
Were you aware that the Gallipoli expedition was heading for failure at the time?
Well, I began to think that towards the end, before I left, people began to realise it was pretty hopeless because we couldn't possibly get any further. You see, unfortunately, the landing at Suvla had failed. The landing at Suvla was carried out because stalemate had come at Helles, stalemate had come at Anzac, and there seemed to be no hope of anybody breaking through either of these, so it was decided to try the landing at Suvla with, I think, something like 5 or 6 divisions. But unfortunately, it's not my duty to describe what happened. Unfortunately, it was a failure through a couple of days' delay on the beaches, which you can read in history.
Why did you eventually leave the peninsula?
Because I had to go home for an operation caused, I think, through the tummy trouble and mild dysentery which I had. I was sent off for an operation.
How did you feel when you left the peninsula? Were you relieved?
I was very much relieved. I think anybody would have been relieved to have been able to leave the peninsula under honourable circumstances. And I was taken in a fairly small ship to Mudros Harbour, where I was put on an enormous ship, hospital ship. And I inquired what it was. It was the biggest ship in the world. It was the Aquitania. So I said, where's this going to go to? So it's sailing for England at 5 o'clock. Well, I thought, that's fine. I hadn't been home, of course, for well over a year. And then they put a notice up about 12 o'clock. The following officers and other ranks will transfer to the Gloucester Castle this afternoon at about 4 o'clock. Well, this was a very nasty blow, so I decided to do my best to avoid transferring to the Gloucester Castle. So I wandered about the Aquitania and got as low down as I could, hoping that the time would come when the ship had to sail before they got me off. But unfortunately, I was discovered by somebody who said, "They're waiting for you. They're going off onto the Gloucester Castle, you have to come." And as I was going over the side, the captain said, "We've been looking for you for half an hour." So actually I'd failed in my attempt to get home on the Aquitania. So I went to Malta instead.
Were you operated on in Malta?
No, I wasn't. Actually, I was a walking case in Malta. And I was only there, I think, a few days. And I was put on an Italian hospital ship called the Re d'Italia and was taken home to England, which took 2 weeks. And then I was asked where I would like to go into hospital. And I said Manchester. And of course the old joke came about that Manchester's full, you can go somewhere else. And they always mentioned 2 places as far away as they could. And eventually I went to London, Queen Alexandra's Hospital, I think it was, if I remember rightly. My father, who knew an eminent surgeon in Manchester, got me transferred to Manchester for the operation, which I had. I then had some leave at home, and I was then sent down to join the 3rd 5th Lancashire Fusiliers at Tunbridge Wells, which were in the 66th Division, which division afterwards distinguished themselves in the fighting in France. But I didn't appreciate the soldiering at home. It wasn't the same as when you were abroad. There was too much red tape. The officer didn't have much to do, as the men seemed to be trained by the sergeant majors and the sergeants. And you didn't feel as though you were as free as you did when you were abroad, where you were treated as an experienced soldier. You weren't under a lot of red tape, you were just under the orders of your immediate commander. And so I decided I wanted to go back and rejoin my battalion. So having applied for this, I was transferred to the 4th, 5th Lancashire Fusiliers, which was the sort of holding battalion which held the drafts and for people who went abroad again. And eventually sailed with a small squad of people, our own battalion, from Devonport in Devonshire, and went back and rejoined the unit at Suez.
Would you have been so keen to rejoin your unit if it had still been in active service in, for instance, Gallipoli? Or
that is what they call a £60,000 question, I think. I don't know. That's rather a difficult one, that is, because I knew they weren't there, so I didn't have to think about it.
What was the condition of your battalion when you rejoined it?
It had been filled up with drafts of officers from other regiments. We had officers from the Gloucesters, and we had, amongst these officers, we had two or three who'd been rubber planters in Malaya.
Had the character of the battalion changed from the early days after its Gallipoli experience?
Oh, no, I don't think so. No, except that, of course, there were so many casualties that we had a lot of fresh people that I didn't know when I went back.
Was it still basically from the Bury area, though, that the...
No, not at all, no. No. No, they were just drafted in from, I don't know, various places. I don't know where it came from. But having got to Suez, we were soon transferred across the canal to a place called Aon Musa on the other side, which means Moses' well, and it's supposed to have been a place where the children of Israel stopped on their journey into the desert. And we were at Aon Musa for 2 or 3 weeks, and then we were moved to other places on the canal. We went to a place called, which was our name, not the Egyptian name, called Ballybunion, which was, you got to it by a light railway from a place called Bala, which is, of course, a town on the canal, and Bala is still there. And then we were there until we eventually, the Turks, made their attack in 1916 with a division coming across the desert to attack the canal in Egypt. And we were then moved up to go and meet this and join in the Battle of Romani.
What did you, before we get on to that, just briefly, what were you doing at Aon Musa and Ballybunion?
Digging trenches, that's the main thing. Just digging defences. You see, I believe that some big general had been to the canal and had discovered that the defences of the canal were on the west side of the canal. And he had remarked that the canal was defending the soldiers, and it would be better if the soldiers commanded the canal, defended the canal and got them moved across, and that's why we were on the other side of the canal.
Yeah, well, did the men find...
the desert side of the canal.
Did the men find difficulty in digging trenches in sand?
No. Oh, no, we had to revet them, of course, the trenches. They had to be revetted with wooden fences and things, you know. Sandbags.
Now getting on to the Battle of Romani, what part did your battalion play?
Well, we didn't play any part because we were entrained at El Cantara and we were detrained at Kilo 42. And we could hear firing going on. And as we marched towards where the battle was in progress, the firing stopped, and by the time we had arrived there, the Turks had retired. So we didn't get into any action in the Battle of Romani.
So what was the next...
Well, the next thing was to follow the Turks up. And then we had a long march from Romani into Katior Oasis. And I think that this march took about 2 days. And on the second day, our battalion were on a sort of outpost duty, and my company was in reserve. And the next day, when we had to continue the march to Katia, my company was the advance guard for the whole division. And the only people in front of us were Australian horse, Australian horse people. And it was a long march, I should say about 16 miles, soft sand. Everybody was carrying 200 rounds of ammunition. It was in August. It was very hot indeed. And there was a difficulty over the water question because it was practically impossible to stop the men drinking water. They got so thirsty. And when we did arrive in Katia, I had only a few men fallen out because I told the officer to march behind the men instead of in front of them. And I myself marched behind the company to try to stop any people falling out. But the battalion, which was coming behind, I think had about 80 men who fell out on the march. And some of them were trying to dig water under palm trees and things like that. And some of them really had gone quite a bit peculiar in the head through this. And when we arrived at Katia Oasis, we didn't know whether the Turks were there or they weren't. However, we got in and there was no Turks there. There was a well, and I asked, everybody of course fell under the palm trees and exhausted, and I asked our volunteers to fill the water bottles, and I didn't get any reply. So Sergeant Major Jones and myself went and filled the water bottles ourselves. We strung them on the horse, which I had not ridden all the way. I'd walked like the men, as I thought I ought to do. And we filled the water bottles, and that was it. And we remained in Katia Oasis for some 2 or 3 weeks before we continued the advance following up the Turks. Well, I must put it in the reason why you couldn't go any quicker was because they were building the railway from Kantara to Jerusalem and also laying a pipeline of water, and so we had to wait until these things were advanced and then make another move forward. This is why it took considerable time. And there was one occasion when we understood the Turks were on a sort of ridge in the desert, and two divisions were sent to attack this ridge, which ours was one. But before we got there, the Turks retired again. So there was no fighting again. And this sort of thing went on until we eventually arrived at El Arish. And this became the end of our stay on the desert. And from there we went to France.
Well, but by now, had you become company commander by now?
Oh, yes, I was a company commander as soon as I got back into Egypt.
Did this entail any special duties that you can remember?
No, no special duties. The ordinary duties of a company commander to look after his company.
That's all it involved?
That's all it involved, yes.
When did you... in these periods when you weren't actually advancing in the desert, could you describe the sort of lifestyle, how you lived? Did you have tents or...?
Yes, and some places we had tents. We had some tents in Romani, and we were taken, I think, once or twice to the seaside called Mohammedia, where we could bathe and having holidays, as it were. We weren't put on to drills or do anything. We just was a rest camp, as it were. Otherwise, we were just living in the desert, and if there was anything we were ordered to do, such as dig at any trench or anything, we had to do that. Otherwise, we weren't doing very much. We were supposed to be trained soldiers. We were just waiting for orders to continue the advance.
Was it at all boring?
No, not really, no, because, you know, there were a lot of chaps there, and we found somewhere playing some games of some sort or another, and then we could sit round a fire, which we made out of the scrubs of the desert, at night, and have a sing song and all that. No, no, it was quite pleasant on the desert.
Did you have any special songs you sang that you can remember? Or?
Not, I can't remember any that were sang there on that particular occasion, no. The men used to start up some songs or other. They weren't always very exciting, you know.
Did the officers join in?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Did you feel you were close to your men, and did you know them all by name?
Well, you see, there were a different lot of men to originally. The original platoon I had when we first went to Egypt, of course, I knew them very well. And even today, I can remember the names of 53 out of 61. But not when I got back again a second time. Most of these people had gone, either killed or wounded or taken home or sick or something. And they were a different lot. There were a few of the old ones, but I can't now recall the names of who they were there then. Besides, what I'm trying to say is that when we were in Egypt, I had just a platoon. Now I had a company, which was much bigger than the platoon. I didn't expect it to know all the men in it. The platoon commander was supposed to do that job.
When did you get your first news that you were on the way to France?
When we were in Alarich, and I think it was somewhere about the end of January or beginning of February 1917.
Did you get any special kit for going to France? Or
yes. We had Christmas on the desert. I remember that quite well. And after that, we were told we were going to France. The railway, of course, had reached Alarich, and we went back by railway, and we had a march to Moasca camp, where we were fitted out with a different kind of clothing, because, of course, it was winter there in England then, and in end of January, beginning of February. It was winter and very cold, so, of course, we'd been living in shorts and shirts and things like that. So we were fitted out again to go to France, and then we were embarked on a ship whose name, just at the moment, I can't remember, and we sailed to Marseille. And of course you might be interested to know, we nearly got torpedoed on the way.
Could you describe that incident?
Yes, we were in the Mediterranean in a convoy, and we had with us two destroyers. And one day I was talking to another of our officers in his cabin. The signal for a parade, a boat parade, was 6 blasts on the whistle, and 7 blasts on the whistle was the genuine thing and not a practice. And I was talking to this officer when this whistle began to blow, and of course we said, oh heavens, here's an